From SDPB Radio, I'm Chris Loffrey, and you are listening to In the Moment, and this is your weekly news podcast. The South Dakota Corn Growers Association welcomed President Trump's announcement last week that he is directing the Environmental Protection Agency to maintain the renewable fuel standard. So, what will this mean for corn growers and ethanol producers in the state? Lisa Richardson is the executive director of the South Dakota Corn Growers Association and joined SDPB's Jackie Hendry to answer this question and more.
I'm hoping you can bring us up to speed to start off with. Tell us a little bit about these renewable fuel standards and what this impact is going to be.
Sure. Senator Daschle started a program, introduced the legislation called the Renewable Fuel Standard, or we've referred to it as the RFS. The person who actually got it passed was Senator Thune, and it was RFS 1 and then RFS 2. And in it, it has different statutory requirements for like cellulosic ethanol, and then what advanced biofuels, and then what we call corn-based ethanol. And Administrator Pruitt and Administrator Wheeler started giving waivers out to the refining industry. And this last round of waivers was well over 2 billion gallons. Over the past, since Trump has been there, he has waived over 4 billion gallons of ethanol. Well, what does that mean to corn growers and the ethanol industry? In South Dakota, we produce about 800 million bushels of corn. About 400 million, about half our product, actually goes to ethanol production across the state. So it was a huge demand decrease in corn growing. We currently have across the country, about 21 ethanol plants idle. Means not running due to all these waivers. So what the president announced last week, and we're very optimistic, we think it's a step in the right direction, the RFS, and then they have these volume requirements. And there, you know, as I explained, there's different levels, and ours was 15. He is raising it, and we haven't seen the paper on it, but to about 16.3 billion gallons. He did a three-year average to account for all of these waivers that the EPA has granted to the oil industry.
So the RFS truly sounds like a South Dakota rooted effort from Daschle to Thune to get the first version passed.
Yep.
And I just want to outline again, because this was surprising to me, you're saying 800 million bushels of corn produced in South Dakota, 50% of that goes to ethanol production. I have that right?
So For everyone out there listening, ethanol is a huge industry to the state, okay? Now this year we're not going to produce 800 million bushels because we have a substantial of our land due to the wetness not planted. But historically, we use about 350 to 400 million for ethanol. We use 80 million for all livestock combined, and the rest we export out of the state, primarily to other countries.
And these exemptions from RFS for oil companies, again, impacting that demand. So really a negative impact for South Dakota corn growers.
Yep. We have plants that are running at half capacity. None are, to my understanding, most are not running at full capacity. So yeah, this is welcome news. Obviously, the devil is always in the details, but we're optimistic that this will give us a piece of the market back.
Great. As far as this announcement goes, there's multiple pieces of this that the EPA is going to be accepting comments on various acts, but kind of run us through again. Now that these exemptions less in play following the law of the RFS, how is this, with the optimism, point us to what we think this is going to look like, how this is going to change the current situation as far as getting that market back?
It's not going to change it overnight, but there's, I'm using a lot of acronyms, but there's this how they value the RFS is they call them RINs, and that's a renewable identification number. And those values of those RINs, if you don't blend ethanol, then you have to purchase RINs. Even when ethanol, and historically right now we do have relatively low oil prices, but we have very low commodity prices, very low ethanol prices as well. And ethanol is a huge octane, so when you buy 10% ethanol, you bump the octane up. So this will companies that just physically won't give us access to the market, we hope this will perhaps and give a nudge to make what I'm going to call a Bob, another strange name, but it's what they put in the pipeline you blend with it, that we can use E15 in the southeast and in some of the areas across the country. And then these RIN prices will be substantially less. So this is a big deal because EPA candidly has given an oil a pass on all of it, and they've really gutted the renewable fuel standard.
Tell us how we're hearing the importance to South Dakota in particular, but on a national scale, what does this move indicate as far as our move towards ethanol?
Well, on a national scale, the exciting thing about ethanol is it's clean burning. It has a lower carbon footprint. The other piece for all of your listeners out there, South Dakota has actually started benchmarking their soils. Most of our ethanol right now is going into California. It's called to CARB, the California Air Resource Board, and they get a higher value based upon their carbon footprint. So ethanol, which increases your octane, if our country produces higher compression engines, it emits less in the air. We have less toxin. Initially, ethanol was put in because it's an oxygenate. It puts oxygen back in the air. It is clean burning. So it's, for the country as well, it's a win.
I'm going to talk a little bit more generally now, if you don't mind, about the role of corn in South Dakota agriculture. And as we move into conversations about the future of the ag industry and the future of renewable energy and clean energy and things like this, how are you seeing biofuels becoming an even bigger part of South Dakota's future? If we're hearing about 50% of our corn production in an ag state going towards this, what are kind of the indicators that you're seeing as the direction we're moving?
Well, actually, instead of working on federal policy, I see a lot of state initiatives happening. I see there's a low carbon fuels program in California. There's one in Oregon. Colorado is looking at passing one through their state legislature. The Northeast, Maine, New Hampshire, that area is looking at that as well. And so that they're looking at it for the environment. And we in South Dakota, the way we produce our corn and the technology that's in these ethanol plants, we can meet that standard. We're very, very, very sustainable and very clean. So I suspect and believe that it will grow long term.
What are the major obstacles, I guess, in this growth? Now that this announcement has been made, what are some of the things that you're watching and hopeful about as far as next steps, maybe?
There's a couple things out there. You know, access to the marketplace is all that corn growers are looking for. We always talk about getting underneath the canopy. So when you pull up to get gas, that canopy, and you have a choice, we're just looking to get some what we would call shelf space, so we can compete head-to-head with oil. And oil has kept us out of that very strongly. And so just a right to compete for a clean-burning, very self-environmentally safe product, that's what we're looking for long-term.
Through the month of October, South Dakota Public Broadcasting is taking an in-depth look at the future of farming in South Dakota. We're exploring technologies that are radically changing farming practices, examining innovative responses to a variable climate, and meeting the people who are preserving the land, saving the farm, and feeding the planet. Tuesday, we heard about climate trends in South Dakota. Laura Edwards is South Dakota's state climatologist. She joined us from the Tom and Danielle Ammon Foundation studio at Northern State University in Aberdeen. She spoke with In the Moment host Lori Walsh.
Laura, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, good morning, Lori.
Tell us a little bit about the Fourth National Climate Assessment. How are we gathering some data about trends in South Dakota in the coming future?
Yeah, the fourth National Climate Assessment was released last November, and it's an update that they do every few years now on the state of the nation's climate, but not just, you know, trends in temperature and precipitation, but also what are those impacts across the country. And they divide that down into different regions, such as us in the Northern Great Plains. And they also talk about things such as what's happening in agriculture or our water resources or with indigenous peoples and communities. And so they really touch a lot of different aspects of how climate and how a changing climate is affecting us here locally.
All right, let's start with some of those trends first, and then we'll get into some of those challenges and opportunities. Talk about temperature first. How are we sort of seeing this impact the state and the region?
Sure. Yeah. Here in South Dakota, we have seen warming temperatures in general. When we look at an annual basis, you know, it's been a couple degrees over the last century. When you compare the early 1900s to the early 2000s, we have seen warming overall. But most of that warming we see in the winter season. It's not even across all the seasons of the year. And we see the least warming in the summer season, which is kind of interesting because that's our growing season, and for agriculture, that is important. And as we look forward into the future, there's pretty strong consensus that we will continue to see warming temperatures in the coming decades.
And precipitation, it certainly seems like a year, at least in southeast South Dakota, where it felt like it might be on the rise. What is the overall trend?
And you know, this year has kind of shown that in spades, right? Yeah. With a big asterisk on the top of precipitation. But certainly, you know, when we look at the National Climate Assessment, their data is showing that South Dakota is getting wetter faster than most other states in the country, 15 to 20% wetter now than 60, 70 years ago, even. And so, again, though, kind of like temperature, it's not evenly increasing across all the seasons. At least in the recent, you know, several decades, we've seen it more in the spring and the fall season, which I'm sure a lot of our farmers and ranchers can attest to, with all the challenges with both planting in the spring and harvesting in the fall, and a lot of the spring flooding as well that we've seen in the last, you know, 20, 25 years.
Right. So all these things are not spread out evenly. You know, we see their impacts greater at greater times, places, seasons, which makes it a little more difficult to kind of make adjustments, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's really a logistical challenge. But, you know, working with my colleagues at SDSU Extension and with USDA, with their Natural Resources Conservation Service and others, you know, there are some things that farmers and ranchers can do to kind of adapt or make them more resilient to these extremes. And a lot of those farming practices fall under what they call soil health practices, doing things like planting cover crops during the off season in between their cash crop, or reducing the tillage that they do to reduce their potential for soil erosion in these heavy rain events. So, you know, I think we have some strategies already in our pocket that we can pull out, which are a little bit different than kind of our traditional or conventional ways of doing things. But I think it's time to try those out again and try to adopt some of those practices.
Let's talk about some of the challenges and opportunities regarding climate going forward. And let's start with the increasing in precipitation and these heavy kind of rain events. Are there opportunities here for farmers in South Dakota?
I think that's the story with a changing climate here in South Dakota, is that they're both opportunities and challenges. And, you know, in the last few decades, we've been able to take advantage of our increasing precipitation, you know, to improve our yields, to grow different crops such as corn and soybeans, which haven't been grown here historically. But the challenges that come with that are the potential for flooding, as we've seen just very widespread this year, and the challenges of getting traffic across the fields, you know, with soil moisture just being exceptionally high. But the other thing too, is is that we see more rain coming in heavy events. This year is kind of, we've seen heavy events for sure, but we've seen a lot of little events. What we see moving forward is more of our precipitation coming in heavy events. And so that's another kind of question for farming is how can we better protect our soils from heavy erosion and those heavy events.
And how does it affect the crop then at harvest time as well? If there's, you know, if you said that precipitation is really increased in the fall, does that change the harvest itself and the moisture content of the crop?
Yeah, it does. And that's what we've seen a lot of recent years, including this year, is that the moisture in the grain is still high at harvest time. And that's an added expense to dry it down and get it ready for storage or to ship somewhere. And so that's one of our challenges here, especially in the fall season.
All right. If the crops are growing well and longer, you know, even if they aren't flooded out, it seems like there's also going to be those weeds are going to. I know the thistles in my backyard are doing quite well this season. So how does this impact weeds and pests?
Yeah, that's right. With a longer growing season and, you know, sufficient moisture, we do see a longer weed season, too, and a longer pest season in general. And we see a lot of those pests moving up from the south that are acclimated to that longer growing season, warmer temperatures. And, you know, as I said earlier, our temperatures are warming in the winter. And so that allows overwintering of a lot of these pests and diseases that usually we historically we haven't had to worry about. And so that's one of the challenges, I think, moving forward is being ready for those. You know, and again, our southern neighbors, a lot of times I've dealt with them already. So I think we can just take that knowledge and hopefully adapt it to us in South Dakota.
How about for livestock? When we look at, you know, different precipitation or increasing temperatures, how does that affect livestock in South Dakota?
Yeah, so there's a couple things there in play with livestock. One is what we saw earlier this year with very wet springs and a lot of mud, not great conditions for calving and lambing, where you can get some more disease early on in when they're very, very young animals. And the other thing, too, though, with increased temperatures, especially in that spring season as we transition from the colder temperatures to warmer temperatures, we can see more heat stress with a rapid warm-up during kind of an odd time of year, you know, early in the season. And so I've been working a lot with a couple of our livestock colleagues at SDSU to help address the heat stress and animal health issues that we're seeing with climate as well.
Hmm. Are we seeing issues with drought and, you know, the fire? You know, we haven't been talking about the fire season in the Black Hills hardly at all for the last, you know, several months because of the precipitation we've been seeing this season and last. But that's also on the radar for as the climate changes or as we look at climate trends, what happens in the Black Hills Forest? Are we at risk for drought and forest fire?
Yeah, I think that is true. We still worry about fire. You know, we've been talking so much about our increase in precipitation in rainfall and snowfall, but we are in a highly variable climate, you know, up here in the Northern Plains, and we still will see drought. We still will see heat waves. It's not all just about rainfall, but you know, wet years like this allow all that vegetation to grow, and that's what puts us at risk later of wildland fire. And my colleague Dr. Darren Claybo at the School of Mines is really great at talking about that weather and climate impacts on wildland fire. But you know, that's another kind of nuance in the precipitation story, let's say, is that our general trend is increasing, but we can still see, you know, really rapid drought onset, such as what we saw in 2017 in the spring, a very rapid onset of a very severe drought. And we've seen some other very quick transitions in 2011 from the very wet year and the record Missouri flood that year, transitioning to one in a 50-year to 100-year drought in 2012. And so we still will see, I think, a lot of these ups and downs, which I think is the challenge there. And how can we adapt in a farming economy and culture and lifestyle to these big swings that we will see in both temperature and precipitation.
As we look at, how farmers and producers are really preparing, how they're looking at soil health, how they're looking at just different, as you mentioned, practices, cover crops and reducing tillage. Are there other things, because there's other people who are looking to get into a production that maybe they didn't have before because, what used to be dry is now wet. What used to be, and there might be potential that they haven't seen in certain acres that they're seeing now. How are you sort of advising farmers as they look at trends and, how far out do they have to sort of look into the crystal ball?
Yeah, and I think a lot of farmers that I have visited with, they're thinking of their generations ahead, their children and their children's children, and they want the land to still be productive decades from now. And I think that's the time horizon they have in the back of their mind. But realistically, they're making decisions now on what they're going to do next year already, right? And when it comes to thinking about climate, climate smart agriculture is one of the words I've heard thrown around. When we're thinking about climate smart agriculture, part of it is kind of thinking differently, and it maybe trying some different things. I think technology and some of the precision ag type things can also help a little bit when you're out on the farm, and maybe tailor some of your planting and nutrient and fertilizer decisions to every acre out there. I think those are all useful technologies. But again, we don't have to always reinvent the wheel, and let's try some low-tech things too that maybe don't cost as much, especially in this tough economy that we're dealing with right now.
Give us an idea before we let you go just a little bit about 2019, because we started there, and let's wrap up with that. How did it fit into, the overall picture as we look at, and I know the year's not over yet, but from what we know now, but what we have endured, what's the historical picture?
Yeah, I mean, no question, it's been a very tough year from start to finish, and we're not quite finished yet. And just before this, we heard the Missouri River report on their forecast runoff. We've had unbelievable amount of precipitation out here, and generally kind of relatively cool season in general, which has really slowed things down. Looking at the crop reports from yesterday, we're a couple weeks behind of where we typically are, but we're seeing record rainfall already, and it's only early October, and we still have almost 3 months to go. Same in the Missouri River. We've already seen I think the second highest runoff in the river, and we still have 3 months to go in the year. So this has been quite exceptional in many ways, I think we're getting through this. I think next year we still will have a little bit of a challenge, especially fighting some of the weeds and the soil moisture right away in the spring. As you heard, our soil moisture may freeze and lock in till the spring season. So we've seen some wet years like this previously, like 2009, 2010. So I know we can make it through, but it's going to be a tough go.
You can find all of our Future of Farming segments on our website, listen.sdpb.org. If you want to be part of the conversation, send us an email, inthemoment@sdpb.org. Please use Future of Farming in the subject line. Elevate Rapid City is a new and innovative approach to economic development for Rapid City and the Black Hills region. President and CEO Tom Johnson joined In the Moment from the Black Hills Surgical Hospital Studio in SDPB's Black Hills Studio to tell us about plans to improve the region's economy.
One of the challenges or even criticisms you hear often about the Rapid City economy is its focus on tourism and what that means for people who are living and working in that economy. Talk a little bit about diversifying and kind of bringing in a broader base of industry and business to sort of make it less one-dimensional.
You know, you're right. It is definitely a tourism-based economy. Although I would say the healthcare sector has been growing, and it's also a regional retail center as well. Really, we know two things: that the selling of low taxes and low cost of doing business isn't really how you sell companies and workers of the future. We know that quality of life matters. And so if you think about why tourists come here in the first place, they're getting some of that quality of life. And so I think what we do is have to recognize that we can leverage that quality of life, that often tourism is the front door, and everything begins with a visit, as Julie Jensen likes to say, with Visit Rapid City. And so we just have to leverage those relationships and social networks. There are a lot of people that have visited South Dakota or the Rapid City area or the Black Hills who have gone to school here that are other places. They would like the opportunity to come back. So if we approach it from a relationship standpoint and we approach folks that have seen this place and been here and want to be here, it's a lot easier to sell this area and grow this economy than if we just lead by saying, hey, come to Rapid City or South Dakota because we have low taxes. It's more complex than simply that message.
You mentioned elevating an entire community, and you talked about the magic and mystical sort of feeling that you got as a child coming here. And it seems that we need to talk about the Lakota people and the land that this was, and the people who have had a relationship with the land the longest, because some people would say the right word is sacred. So tell me a little bit about economic growth and poising for growth, but also partnerships with tribal communities.
By the way, that's a great observation. And I think some of my experiences in Wyoming in my last job at Colorado State University, where I worked on community engagement, where I was able to work really with indigenous peoples on things like the bison reintroduction on the Wind River Indian Reservation, I think has prepared me for some of those conversations. Obviously, the history is scarred with some of what you've mentioned. I think what we've got to do is recognize that elevate is a verb, so we've got to take action and recognize that we have to elevate the entire area for all peoples and all cultures, and that means a respect, a reverence for those indigenous peoples, but also reaching out, and not just once or twice and with lip service. Keep showing up over and over, trying to give that message of inclusivity and diversity, and just keep showing up. You can't build trust by showing up once and saying, hey, I'm here with Elevate and we want to help. You have to have a real dialogue, keep showing up, take their perspective, and work through some of the issues through dialogue that's important to them. So, like I said, I'm going to roll up my sleeves and I'm going to keep showing up and keep showing up and keep showing up until I can build those relationships and trust that will allow us to go where we want to go. You can only get so far that trust will allow, and that includes the relationship that we'll have with all cultures and peoples of the area.
How does Elevate Rapid City fit into that conversation about an emerging workforce, or skill development, or even attracting new people to a community?
Well, that is a very complex question. That's almost like how do we build the economy when it has so many different parts? But from the workforce perspective, I would go back to relationships. We know that South Dakota has exported many, many of its talented workforce. We have, through the use of data, we can access lists of folks that have left the area, that have gone to school here, that grew up here, and we can encourage them to come back. So I think the old way of just saying, hey, come to Rapid City, we'll provide workforce training dollars, it's just not good enough. We've got to find those workers, especially in a time of really low unemployment. We have to provide that training, provide those funds for training, but also look to relationships outside to recruit those workers here. So, for example, if you have a nursing shortage, you can use data to find out where are there supplies of nurses that also coincide with where your alumni and folks that have grown up here are, and you can reach out to those folks. So we're gonna use data to inform some of the decisions we're making around workforce. But the workforce equation is just as complex as the economic development equation, and it takes a long view, and it requires a lot of relationship building, and then also just not to get too intoxicated with the idea that you need to bring 500 jobs all at once, because you can't absorb that kind of workforce.
Makes a nice headline, but
get your paper, get your picture in the paper, right. And the governor signs a proclamation maybe, but it doesn't really develop the economy as in a more organic, holistic way. So those 10, 15, 20 person companies, or those even 5 or 2 person expansions, they're not going to get the press, but they're going to mean a lot to those businesses, certainly, especially those businesses that are maybe native owned, but also just for the larger economy, they're going to add up, and you have to focus on that as well. It's not just about recruiting, it's about entrepreneurship, existing business, community development, workforce, and leadership as well.
South Dakota lawmakers have begun writing a bill that would legalize industrial hemp next year. U.S. Senator Mike Rounds bemoans the bitter mood in Washington, and pre-construction on the Keystone XL pipeline kicks into gear. Dakota Political Junkie's Mike Card, professor of political science at the University of South Dakota, and Seth Tupper, enterprise reporter for the Rapid City Journal, joined Lori to discuss the issues.
All right, let's start with hemp, because this hemp legislation and the study committee that has been doing research over the summer, starting to write some legislation, but holding off for the U.S. Department of Agriculture's announcement later in the year for hemp program guidelines. Mike Card, start us off with how did this become not just something that we were trying to figure out from a legislative standpoint, but really a battle between the governor and these lawmakers?
Well, if we think way back, hemp was outlawed several decades ago as part of the war on marijuana. Although hemp had been used and was a major part of South Dakota's economy for ropes and things of that nature. Most recently, in the most recent farm bill, hemp was authorized to be grown and taken off the list of controlled substances. Hemp is a different plant than marijuana, although they are very similar in their appearance. And then a bill to authorize hemp growing and the like in South Dakota was introduced and was vetoed by Governor Noem. The legislature put together a study committee for the summer to work on addressing the concerns. And Governor Noem, I believe, suggested that she would veto the bill. And I think that's where we are right now, is they're working on a bill. She has listed 315 questions in a letter to the committee that she would like answered. They have responded that they would like the executive branch to deal on those. Their job is to do policy, not to implement it. And I think that's where we are.
Let's talk about those 315 questions and Governor Noem's speaking out against hemp. Seth Tupper, she wrote an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal saying, I'm going to veto it again, and here's why. But what about these 315 questions? As you look at them, there's a really detailed assessment of things that she wants to know about what happens next if this legislation is passed. Have you seen that before?
No, and it's hard to take that list of 315 questions as anything but sort of a grandstanding. You don't often see that. It's kind of a over-exaggeration to prove a point, obviously, that she has what she thinks are serious concerns about hemp, and and to show just how serious, she's throwing 315 questions at the wall.
Like they had a brainstorming session and somebody took notes and then put them all together
out. It is sort of amazing that the lengths and extent that she went to make a point, and she made it, I guess. There's a lot of questions, but that's been one of the most confusing things about this, really, I think, for the public. is that, you know, on one hand, you have Governor Noem saying that there are all kinds of serious and long-lasting public safety impacts that police officers and highway patrol officers can't, you know, readily tell the difference between hemp and marijuana. And then on the other hand, you have other people saying, and I've interviewed some of these people in other states, saying that actually it's no problem at all, that, you know, you pick somebody up who has something that appears to be hemp or marijuana, you check to see if they're licensed, a licensed hemp grower here or in another state, and if they're not, you arrest them. And some people say it's just that simple. So it's been really perplexing to watch it unfold, that on the one hand, so many people thinking this is just a simple issue. Hemp is not something that can get you high, and it has economic value, so why can't we grow it? And on the other hand, you know, the governor taking a completely opposite approach, saying that this is a danger to public safety.
And a social experiment.
Yeah, yeah. And it's hard for some people to understand that, how something that's not intoxicating can be viewed in this way. And something that, as Mike mentioned, has had past economic value in this country and has been an industrial product before.
All right, so a couple things. There's so many questions here. And Mike Card, I kind of want 315 questions about every piece of legislation. And what I'm getting at there is, you know, it seems like sometimes things are passed that, you know, we'll all sort of scratch our heads and say, did they think about the potential impact of this? And then things will have to get kind of, detangled later on down the road. I've never seen, in my, you know, limited experience, this comprehensive of an assessment of legislation before it's even been written. Why not do it more often?
Well, it's partly the cost. And often in implementing a bill, it is done by the administrative agency that has to implement the bill.
Okay.
You know, my own personal experience was in shifting over from the Comprehensive Employment and Training Act to the Job Training Partnership Act, and there were more than 315 questions that we had about who's eligible and how should we do this and who's going to pay for the training and how are we going to get it done. And in here, it's who's going to do the testing, what are the sampling protocols. And I believe that the chairman of the Interim Study Committee said that's the administration's issue, is to answer those questions.
Yeah.
And a policy question is, should we do this or not? And to give guidance to the administrative agency in terms of implementing the bill.
Fascinating. All right, so I was in the bookstore this weekend and I picked up a random, you know, everything's got CBD oil on the cover right now and instructions about this, and I picked up a random thing and it was talking about the journey from something that an illegal substance to medicinal to decriminalized to legal. And what else could go that route? And Mike, this is the sort of thing that Governor Noem is arguing for, saying, like, this is part of an overall strategic process that other people want, and what we're really going to end up with is legalized marijuana, and that's part of what we're standing against right now. Is this about hemp? Or is this about marijuana? Or is this about telling the legislature to listen to what she says? Is this a power play between the two groups? Is it about hemp or is it about marijuana? What do you think?
Well, I think it's become a power play between the two groups. I certainly can't interpret anyone's private motives for what they do, but the longer we talk about it, we will get closer to what you had mentioned was a later topic, which was bitterness in Washington. We'll probably have some bitterness in Pierre, and it may be over this issue where some see economic opportunity when corn and soybean prices are very low and we're having people not be able to run their farm at an efficient scale, and this looks like something that could help, and it doesn't have to be planted as often. And yet, on the other hand, what we're bringing up is, well, this is a slippery slope, and I suspect that great care has to be taken. One of the other issues is it has been not lawful, except under special permitting conditions, to study the effects of marijuana or of hemp on the body. And so there aren't very many random controlled double-blind studies on the effects of CBD oil. So is it effective? Well, people swear by it, but I also know people that, you know, swear by Absorbine Junior to keep the gnats away. And sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't.
Seth, all this sort of began with, once I start giggling, Mike, sometimes I don't stop, so you have to be careful. Seth, this is the first legislative session, I don't want to say power play, but this initial sort of bumping of heads between the governor and the legislature happened early on, after she was sworn in as governor. Now we're kind of churning toward that next legislative session. What are we kind of learning about what kind of governor Kristi Noem intends to be?
Oh, well, certainly I think we're learning. I think we knew that from what kind of U.S. representative she was, that she believes in taking stands when she thinks it's worth it. And if she's not afraid to assert herself, and I think that's the kind of politician that she's always been. That's not surprising. She's different from Governor Dugard in that way, that I think we saw in Governor Dugard, a governor who was more prone to work behind the scenes rather than sort of, make a hard and firm public stand. He did, Governor Dugard had to cut the budget his first year in office, and his first weeks and months in office, but he did that by traveling the state and holding listening sessions in the communities and really trying to build a consensus was the way he approached it, whereas Governor Noem on this, on the hemp issue, seems to be saying that if she has to be the last one standing on the hill, protecting against this, she will, and she's willing to do that. And so it's a very different style than the previous governor.
All right, let's follow what Mike Card said about bitterness in Washington, because U.S. Senator Mike Rounds, was here in the state. And, of course, people are asking him about what's happening in Washington. And he says it's pretty bitter. The president has a unique style. And, Seth, I'm not sure I've heard Mike Rounds say anything that was dangling on that edge until the president has a unique style. How about you?
Yeah, that may be the understatement of the century, right? Unique in talking about Donald Trump. But yeah, it was funny. I read the story, and later in the story, Senator Rounds mentioned that, hey, it could be, I'm paraphrasing here, but, it could be worse. At least we're not assaulting each other, on the floor of the Senate like they were in a civil war. And you do have to come away from that thinking, is that the bar now?
Right.
At least we're not beating each other up. And so that's a real comment on sort of what's going on in Washington right now, is that the fallback position is, hey, it could be worse. Civil War.
Mike Card, what are your thoughts? Because I thought the same thing. I thought, first of all, I think it's unusual for Senator Rounds not to just say something really positive about the president, having, that euphemism of having a unique style. I thought it was noteworthy. And then this notion of, and he also invokes Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton saying, well, we're not having duels either.
Do I need to get a glove out? this is a serious issue for our country, as, starting in the lead up to the 2016 election, the Mueller report indicated that there were foreign countries involved in our election. There was no substantiation that there was a relationship with the president's campaign. And so now we're asking another country to investigate a political rival. And for some people, that's reason for impeachment. And for others, it's just, well, we don't trust the FBI to investigate or the CIA, so we have to ask whoever we can. And we are, if nothing else, perhaps becoming the victim of the sound bites put out by the two particular sides on this issue, that what we hear are the sound bites and not an investigation of whether indeed this was done. And now we see that the president has decided we're not going to give any documents, we're not going to make any executive branch official able to come to the Congress to meet. And so now we have a stalemate, and we just keep escalating up the conflict. And I certainly hope we don't end up in a civil war, but we're certainly having verbal battles.
Right. And I've heard people make the argument that, lives are at stake and people are suffering. And, as we make light and kind of make our jokes about the civil war, from the things that are being done at the border and to people pointing out, you know, the lives that are at stake there, to things that aren't being done, USMCA not being dealt with, trade, you know, family farms going bankrupt. There is a lot of collateral damage to this unwillingness between these two parties to, I don't know, maybe unwillingness isn't the right word, Seth, but the problems and the bitterness and the impeachment struggles and the behavior of the president, and however you are coming at this, there are consequences. There are real consequences in South Dakota beyond just saying, oh, those guys in Washington don't know what they're doing.
Yeah, and I also think it's somewhat, you know, it's somewhat disingenuous when people say, oh, you know, this impeachment thing is making it so we don't get anything else done. Right. You know, before impeachment, not much got done either. Yeah. You know what I mean? Right. You know, the Republicans had both houses of Congress and the presidency and didn't really get anything done on immigration at that time. And, you know, during the Obama presidency, when he was famous for being no drama Obama, you know, we didn't get really anything done as far as comprehensively on immigration and a host of other issues. So, I mean, the gridlock in Washington, you know, goes a lot deeper than just because, you know, some people want to impeach the president. And I'm not sure if it wasn't for impeachment that they'd be getting a lot else done either, because the underlying division is still there. This is just the latest example of it.
Yeah. Well, and Seth's point is an important one, is immigration hasn't been dealt with in at least 20 years. Mm-hmm. And the sides are well drawn, and they are sticking to their positions. And until we can come up with a way to have some form of compromise where neither side is happy, but we start moving in the direction of having a realistic immigration policy, we're not going to do anything except create more tension.
South Dakota has a unique drug law on the books. If you are pulled over and have illegal substances in your bloodstream, you can be convicted of drug possession. It doesn't matter where you took the drugs, and you don't have to physically possess the drugs. It's called possession through ingestion, and in the last 3 years, South Dakota convicted nearly 3,000 people for violations. South Dakota is the only state where ingestion is a felony offense, which can mean prison time. But as SDPB's Lee Strubinger reports, some people say that should change.
Democratic State Senator Craig Kennedy says the law that makes having illegal drugs in your system a felony offense is putting a lot of people behind bars. And Kennedy says it's happening at a time when state prisons are at or reaching critical mass. So he asked himself a question.
You know, is this the best way to deal with this problem? Because frankly, it's a costly way to deal with this problem.
In 2018, Kennedy proposed a bill that reduces the charge of drug ingestion from a felony to a misdemeanor. That move could save the state $51 million over a 10-year period in prison costs and $10 million in jail costs over the same period. The state averages just under 470 prison convictions per year and about 160 jail convictions for Schedule 1 or 2 controlled substances, typically methamphetamine. And the state spends about $11,000 a year per inmate. In 2018, Kennedy's bill failed. He tried passing similar legislation earlier this year, and now state lawmakers are studying the drug law again. Greg Satizan is the state court administrator. He says before changes to the drug laws from reforms passed back in 2013, most prosecutors would charge possession and ingestion.
The ingestion statute existed, it just was very rarely used. And so in 2014, with the legislative change that made it clear, ingestion of a chemical absorbed in the body that's going to be charged has to be charged under the ingestion statute, we certainly saw a dramatic increase in those ingestion convictions.
I believe that the South Dakota legislature has given prosecutors across the state the tools to really protect the public when individuals are possessing methamphetamine or they're ingesting it.
That's former Attorney General Marty Jackley. Now he's state's attorney for Jones County. He says it's common sense that if an individual has meth in their system, they possess it.
Those laws here in South Dakota are really geared to give prosecutors a couple of tools or choices in ultimately charging those cases where an individual may have the actual substance on or near their person, or those that have already ingested the substance and maybe you're driving down our interstate or doing other things that are dangerous to the public and children.
The number of convictions for ingestion of a controlled substance spiked after the drug laws changed in 2013. Jackley says felony ingestion charges are primarily geared towards methamphetamine. South Dakota does have a misdemeanor ingestion charge, and Jackley says that one is commonly used by prosecutors in marijuana cases. Jackley says ingestion and possession are one and the same.
Actually, an ingestion case from a prosecutor's standpoint is easier to prove because they've obviously had the substance and they took it. Whereas sometimes you may get a methamphetamine arrest where there's two or three individuals in the car and it's hard to determine, well, who knew about it, who actually had it. Where on an ingestion case, we know who actually had it and who used it because it's in their urine or in their system.
Jackley says he wants legislators to keep the state ingestion laws on the books.
And these are the tools that help us do just that in protecting the public.
Jackley says ingestion gives prosecutors more leeway than just a possession statute. In the last 15 months, more than 870 individuals were charged for ingestion of a controlled substance. More than 90 of those were cases that involved other serious charges. However, the defendant ultimately pled guilty to ingestion, and the other charges were dropped. That's about 10% of ingestion cases. Libby Screen is the policy director for the ACLU of South Dakota. She says policymakers talk about keeping the ingestion charge as a bargaining chip to get after more serious drug crimes.
And if this data shows us that only, 10 to 11% of cases in which ingestion was used as that bargaining chip, at least that we have a record of, I don't think that alleged tool justifies both the human or the financial cost of keeping this all on the books.
Screen says the $51 million spent keeping people behind bars for ingesting drugs is better invested elsewhere.
Which is treatment for substance abuse and treatment that can actually help folks kick their addictions before they end up in a setting where they're incarcerated.
Legislators continue to study the subject and will meet again later this month. Senator Kennedy says he hopes to bring a recommendation to his colleagues about how to create a drug law that is more effective and efficient. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lee Strupinger in Rapid City.
The Head Start program serves preschool kids and their families across the country. It's often one of the only preschool options in rural areas. The goal? To help kids get from low-income households ready for school. However, in one central South Dakota town, a partnership between Head Start and the local school district is providing preschool for every child. SDPB's Jackie Hendry has more.
What is that?
This is a microphone.
What?
It's called a microphone, so I can record our conversation. Yeah.
Hello. Hello, hello, hello.
Murdo's a town of about 500 people, and it's here that the Jones County School District and the Owyhee Head Start program have teamed up. Misty Chester has been the local Head Start teacher for nearly 15 years. Her classroom is in a district building, and she says you'd need to drive at least 25 miles to find another Head Start class. Chester says Head Start provides important services in rural areas.
Within our town, we have a limited number of resources for daycares, and so there really isn't any other opportunities available at this time.
The play-based curriculum helps kids develop social skills. When weather allows, the students play outside. In the winter months, they can play in the school gymnasium just next door. Lori Esme is the superintendent of the Jones County Schools. She also serves on the Oahe Head Start board. She says playtime and other classroom activities, like story time or puzzles, help students learn to work together and regulate their emotions. Offering these lessons early on for children can enhance what they learn at home and keep them on track once it's time for kindergarten.
You know, just all those things that we just take for granted, that we just think kids just know how to do, some of them just have to have it modeled to them and taught to them. So that's why I think it's so important to have early childhood education.
There's also plenty of early intervention for kids who might need some extra help. Teacher Misty Chester does assessments 4 times a year, looking at students' motor, cognitive, and social skills. She says partnering with the school district adds to what she can offer.
We have the speech teacher. She comes over and does services with the ones that need some speech. And then the special ed teacher also comes over and helps with some of those that just need that extra little boost.
That help can be extra one-on-one time during class or resources Chester sends home for parents. Head Start enrollment generally depends on parents' income status, but there are exceptions. Jones County, like many counties in South Dakota, is considered medically underserved. That's a federal designation for counties with too few primary care providers, high infant mortality rates, high poverty rates, or a large elderly population. Misty Chester explains that designation allows some flexibility in Head Start's income guidelines.
So that we are allowed to have 50% of our kids under income and 50% of them over income. So that helps us to be able to allow for the opportunity to serve more.
The partnership between Head Start and the local schools also means flexibility in class sizes. Superintendent Esme says Head Start is limited to 20 students per class, but the school helps with any overflow.
Miss Misty and I work pretty closely together to make sure that nobody is turned away. You know, we might only have some kids be able to attend 2 days, but we want them here for 2 days, so nobody will ever be turned away from here.
This year, 21 students are enrolled in Murdo's Head Start preschool. Superintendent Esme says she wants to be able to provide early education to as many families as they can.
The school district will just help provide that early education as best as we can until our funding is no longer there. But working with Head Start allows this to happen. Without Head Start, we couldn't have this.
Esme keeps tabs on statewide conversations about preschool, but because Head Start is a federal program, she's most concerned with national conversations about funding.
It's just a matter of getting the federal dollars down to the state level to go out to the local districts to help them. I don't think you'd find anybody who's going to say early childhood education is not important. It's just a matter of getting, I think, the federal dollars here.
Ready? Missy Mouse. Missy Mouse, are you in the yellow house?
Teacher Misty Chester agrees. If anything, she wishes Head Start would expand its income guidelines to accept more students.
But the changing things with Head Start, you know, every year we hear, you know, they want to start cut funding for Head Start programs, and we just keep praying that they don't, because for some of these rural areas, it's our only opportunities.
For kids who think they're just playing with friends and singing songs, preschool programs are really an opportunity to hit the ground running in kindergarten and beyond. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Jackie Hendry in Murdo.
Sixteen-year-old climate activist Greta Thunberg traveled to the Pine Ridge Reservation over the weekend. She joined another young activist, Takata Iron Eyes, who was involved in the 2016 protest against the Dakota Access Pipeline, to talk about climate change. SDPB's China Lockett was there and joined SDPB's Jackie Hendry to tell us more about the events.
China, thanks for being here.
Yeah, good morning, Jackie.
Good morning. So tell us, just to start off, set the scene a little bit, what went on this weekend?
Yeah, so it was pretty last minute, but Greta Thunberg actually stopped by the Pine Ridge Reservation and gave a presentation to a crowd of about 200 very excited people. She was greeted with comments like, you're wonderful and we appreciate what you're doing. Thank you for stopping and you have a lot of courage. Very nice happy crowd. Mm-hmm. And then she spoke about her activism with Takana in front of the crowd. And it's really kind of crazy to see these two young 16-year-old girls speaking to all of these adults. And they're very, very eloquent, much more eloquent than I am.
And these young women have a lot to say about not just climate change and these issues, but about democracy and about mobilizing. Tell us a bit about this first clip you've brought us from Greta.
Yeah, absolutely. So something that they agreed on that they both reiterated during their about an hour-long presentation was the importance of mobilizing, which is great because that's what Greta's been doing. And that's also what Takata's been doing, too. She started out at the No Dapple protest up in Standing Rock in 2016, 2017, which was led by youth activists. And since then, she's been continuing her work with environmental and Native American rights and missing and murdered Indigenous women activism. So they both believe that if you get enough people together, you can change people's mind because we live in democracies. They both do.
And here we have this clip from Greta about that importance of mobilizing.
Because right now, it may not seem like it, but we are actually the ones. We are the ones who have the power. And if we use that power in a good way, then we can accomplish anything. So we just need to fight, and we need to show them what really matters to us, and that this is a matter of life and death for many people. To mobilize and organize, it is so extremely important in times like these. There's so incredibly much one individual can do, and if it's one thing, then mobilize and organize yourself and try everything you can to push in the right direction. We need everyone to push from every possible angle into the right direction. Because if we start doing that, then we have won.
That's Greta Thunberg speaking at Red Cloud Indian School over the weekend. China, tell us a bit how Greta and Takata met.
Yeah, so they both met when they were lobbying Congress in Washington, D.C. Greta came down to the States on a sailboat just a couple of weeks ago because she doesn't believe that she should be flying because of the environmental impact planes have.
Mm-hmm.
And Takata is actually no stranger to Washington, D.C. herself. She spoke at the Women's March a couple of years ago in Washington, D.C., gave a presentation on missing and murdered Indigenous women, Native rights, and environmental activism. So they were both down there lobbying Congress, and at the presentation, they both kind of gushed over each other and said how excited they were to meet each other and somebody else who's 16 years old and talking to adults in Washington, D.C. about what they want to see.
a unique way to form a friendship and a relationship. I know we also have a clip, our next one from Greta, talking about relationship.
We need to realize that everything is related, and we are related to each other, and we should not see each other as groups of us and them, but as a whole us, because we are depending on each other in so many different ways. We are depending on nature, and we are also connected to nature, and we need to see the planet and nature as something which has a value of its own that we cannot own and exploit, I mean, as we want, and it's just so important how we perceive the world.
Now, China, I can't help but notice the relation in that part of the speech about how everything's related to mm-hmm. this Lakota perspective
yes.
of we are all relatives, all my relations. Tell us a little bit about, you mentioned in the start that she was warmly received, but tell us a bit more about how Greta was received in the Pine Ridge community.
Everybody in the Pine Ridge community who spoke to her seemed pretty excited about it. There was a lot of talk about the pipeline protest because the DAPL protest in Standing Rock was a very big deal for, from what I hear from a lot of people in the Native community. It was a huge deal to them, and they were standing up trying to get clean drinking water. Well, this is what Greta is also pushing for with her own activism. So I feel like there's kind of a connection between the crowd and Greta because they shared a common interest, which is saving the environment. And that's also what Takata believed. So they did have a lot of similar crossovers. But Greta, when she specifically said that we are all related and that the planet is related, yeah, that's a traditional cultural belief from Lakota people. So it's very interesting.
Right. And it's easy to forget sometimes, now that we have this young Swedish girl in the headlines, that this climate movement has roots with indigenous leaders. So I want to hear a little bit more from Takata. What does she have to say about this movement?
Takata is hoping that the Keystone XL pipeline is going to not be built. She doesn't want the water to be polluted. She's already talked about oil spills from the Dakota Access Pipeline, which have happened, I think, a little bit over 10 times. So far, they've been minor oil spills, last I heard. So she's hoping to prevent further damage.
And here we have some more from Takata Iron Eyes about the indigenous leaders of this movement.
As people who live in the Midwest, I think that we can all pretty much agree that there's not a ton of awareness and a ton of communication about how detrimental this time right now is in regards to the climate crisis. And so to be the people who are in the streets and talking about it is going to be something that's going to be really powerful. We right now are looking towards the indigenous people of this land, because we are the ones who carry the blueprints for the solutions that everyone is looking for. If you are not including indigenous people in conversations and actions about solutions, the solutions that you create are not sustainable. Because as Nick said, we hold 80% of the world's biodiversity. And so the ways in which that we protect our rights, our ways of life, and our communities are directly correlated to the climate crisis.
So we're hearing about mobilization efforts, and of course we've mentioned the Keystone XL pipeline, and moving towards this event today, how did the speeches that we heard yesterday address the last legislative session's so-called riot-boosting legislation?
Right. So they actually specifically touched on the riot-boosting legislation. They're both against it because they both believe that they should be mobilizing and people should be in the streets, obviously. And they think that that is stifling their rights. Today, they have planned an event to go walk from the banned shell at Memorial Park in Rapid City down to the mayor's office. I think it starts in about 5 minutes here. I'll be here shortly after this interview. they're going to march the mayor's office and protest against the Keystone XL pipeline and draw awareness to climate change all at the same time. So, I mean, obviously they're against it and they're taking steps to show that they don't believe in the riot-boosting bill.
That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. In the Moment airs live on SDPB Radio Monday through Friday at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain. Listen live online or find individual segments at listen.sdpb.org. If you want every In the Moment conversation delivered daily to your mobile device, subscribe to the In the Moment Segments podcast. You can also connect with us on social media. Follow us on Twitter at @MomentSDPB and on Instagram, SDPB In the Moment. The In the Moment podcasts are produced by Josh Heyer. For Josh, Lori Walsh, and Steve Zwemke, I'm Chris Loffrey. Thanks for listening.